This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestine resumes a bid for a full membership status at the United Nations amid a U.S. threat to veto any such move. Britain is gripped by a wave of protests and strikes ahead of a huge energy cost increase. And Pakistan is asking for international aid to deal with the aftermath of a tragic flooding. It has swept much of the country. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestine renews its bid for a full membership at the United Nations despite U.S. threats to block the move. The Palestinian ambassador to the U.N. says that he has started consulting all Security Council members. Riyad Mansour says the issue should move forward given that there is no peace initiative on the table. He added the success of the Palestinian bid would send a signal to Israeli leaders that they can never destroy a two-state solution. Any application for full UN membership needs approval from the 15-member Security Council. The U.S., which holds veto power, is opposed to Palestinian attempts, and now it has reportedly warned that it would veto any such move. In 2012, the General Assembly granted Palestine a non-member status that allows Palestine to participate in the UN and sign treaties, but without the full rights of other members. Political analyst Barry Grossman explains why the United States seeks to block Palestine's full membership at the UN.
The U.S. has made it very clear for a very long time that they would oppose such a move. They certainly opposed Palestine's getting the status of an observer state, and in the past have made it very clear they'll oppose any attempt to become a full member, and they've repeatedly said that Palestinians must not have resort to international organizations and institutions in order to reach a resolution of the Israeli problem. The problem, of course, is that the occupation doesn't want peace. The occupation wants a one-state solution that sees all of Palestine free from Palestinians. They want to, in essence, carry out this long-running ethnic cleansing in order to usurp the entire breadth of traditional Palestinian lands for themselves. And by any measure, that's a violation of both international law and, of course, generally accepted morality, no matter what.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended the Friday sermon and prayer in front of the Red Cross office to show their solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. This as last Monday, Palestinian prisoners started protesting the inhumane detention condition. Our correspondent, Eshef Shannon, reports.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners. Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran has lambasted the Israeli regime for refusing to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and bring its nuclear activities under international supervision.
Indeed, Mr. President, the Israeli regime is the only one in the Middle East that has not acceded to the NPT and refuses to place its nuclear facilities under the comprehensive safeguard regime of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Moreover, this regime impedes all serious international efforts to establish a zone free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East.
The Iranian envoy was speaking at a UN conference on nuclear disarmament as Shah Jahromi lashed out at nuclear weapon states for failing to fulfill their obligations to eliminate their atomic arms. He also criticized them for failing to give security assurances that they will not use nukes against non-nuclear weapon states. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian slammed delegates to the UN conference for refusing to urge Israel to join the NPT. He said the delegates have undermined the achievements of the previous conferences. Amir Abdollahian was speaking with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on the phone. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Protesters have gathered outside the office of the British Energy Regulator in London, and that came after the regulator confirmed the cost of electricity and gas will rise by 80% as of October the 1st.
Energy price cap rise, which has risen to over £300 to £500, is intolerable for working people, for people in poverty, for people out of work in Britain right now. I'm here because our parliamentary political parties have failed us, continue to fail us. Whether Labour or Conservative, they offer no solution to the people already in poverty and in worse situations, and to the people who will be put into poverty come October when this price cap rise comes into effect.
The protest was organized by Don't Pay UK. That is a campaign calling on people to stop paying their bills at the renewed prices. The regulator has partly blamed the increase on the Russia-Ukraine war, and that has led to a curb in Russian energy supplies to Europe. Leaders of the parliaments in Wales and Scotland, as well as the British opposition parties, have called for an immediate freeze on the price increases. Britons are also grappling with soaring food prices. That, coupled with the rising energy prices, sent inflation to above 10% in July, a rate unseen in over 40 years. Meanwhile, the UK's deepening cost of living crisis has set off a wave of industrial action sweeping across the country in recent months. This time, more than 100,000 Royal Mail postal workers have walked off the job in a dispute over pay. The move has been described as the biggest strike action of the summer so far. Said Puraza reports.
If you're a British citizen waiting for a package to be delivered by Royal Mail, expect a delay. More than 100,000 of the company's workers, hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic, have walked out of the job to fight for a wage rise amid a deepening cost of living crisis.
To come into this action, to get your members motivated.
We didn't create this crisis. The oligarchs in every society, the people that are taking dividends and profits, feeding their own fat tummies and making our people wait for a decent pay rise. That's what's causing inflation. But it's also what's causing bitterness between the classes. Now, we've got to make sure that we rebalance that equation.
The bosses at Royal Mail, a 500-year-old multinational, now privatized postal service, claims the Communication Workers Union, which represents these strikers, has rejected a pay rise offer worth up to more than 5% after 3 months of talks. The union's leader says that's simply not true.
The reason why it's a lie is because it doesn't exist. It's a total fabrication, and it's being spun to the media, embarrassingly, really, to try and make the company look as though they're being reasonable when what they're actually doing is just disgraceful. So the real situation is that the company made £758 million profit. The company gave away over £400 million to major shareholders and then imposed a 2% pay increase to the workforce.
The walkout is being described as the biggest industrial action of the summer so far, which has already seen workers strike across the railways, ports, and the courts. They all come at a time when the UK is grappling with its highest inflation rate and soaring energy prices in decades.
Today's strike action is the opening salvo in a dispute that could reshape a British institution, and the strikers tell us that they're in it for the long haul. Saeed Purizam, London.
Scotland is also hit by industrial action. Workers have been refusing to work. They've been on strike for 9 days now over pay dispute with local authorities. The strike began in the capital, Edinburgh, and now it is spreading to more than a dozen cities across Scotland. The action is set to continue until Tuesday, despite talks ongoing between the authorities and union leaders. The workers want higher salaries in line with the rising inflation, and this action has already left its impact with garbage from unattended bins overflowing on the streets. It has caused criticism against the government as well. Opposition politicians are accusing it of apathy in the dispute and shifting blame to local city councils. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Robert Carter, who's joining us from London. Also, we have with us Mick Napier, political activist from Belfast. Let's begin with Robert. Many families are naturally panicking over how they are going to pay their energy bills, and there's also the rising food prices. Some are even describing it as having to make a choice between freezing and starving. How grim is the situation on the ground?
It's getting pretty grim, to be honest with you, and it's affecting people of all walks of life, except, it seems, major business owners and millionaires, essentially, who can weather these types of storms. But things continue to get hard for working ordinary people, the middle class and the lower classes here. But the problem is that you also have a situation now where there is major industrial action taking place, trade unions are springing into action. But what's happening is they're now being demonized as the bad guy in this situation by the ruling government and also elements within the media as well. Essentially, claims that they are holding the country to blackmail during a difficult time, and that, you know, surely it's not the right time to be calling for this type of action because it only makes things worse. The protesters outside Ofgem, the energy regulator, for example, spearheaded, led by a grassroots movement called Don't Pay UK, which is, of course, advocating for people not to pay their energy bills after the 1st of October, and to basically stage a type of strike on their own. They are again being demonized as if they are at fault here. But at the end of the day, these are reactions to something else that's already happened, which is, of course, intolerable living conditions and high prices and very low wages. So the situation is spiraling. We'll have to see how far it spirals. But what we essentially have now is a zombie government headed by Boris Johnson. He's refusing to take any serious decisions in order to kind of alleviate some of this pressure, to kind of do anything about it. He's leaving that to his successor, but the competition for the next leader is still ongoing and won't be settled until, I think, sometime in the second week of September, early September. And of course, then we'll have to still wait and see what action they're going to take. And in the meantime, we just have to sit back and hope for the best. But the situation looks very bleak, so people's hopes are not very high.
Exactly. Let's bring Mr. McNabb here. Now, Britons have had too much on their plate in recent years. We just heard from our correspondent, and also from the Brexit to the pandemic to back-to-back government scandals, and now the war in Ukraine. Which one do you blame the most for the current situation?
You know, it's a perfect storm for this government. The strikes which are taking place, your correspondent says, of course, there's the usual attempt to demonize the strikers, but he knows very well that it's failing, that strike leaders, such as the railway leaders who appear on television, are widely seen to be eloquent, articulate, and the good guys. And the attempts by the Tory government, Labour remains silent most of the time, to smear them, don't seem to be succeeding. Look, I remember the poll tax riots and strikes. And it was a moment for Margaret Thatcher which sealed her doom. The pressure had been building up for years beforehand, but the poll tax was a step too far. And we had people smashing up McDonald's in London squares, but there was widespread support, or at least a refusal to condemn them, because the poll tax was absolutely hated. Now we see a situation where there's terrible fear among ordinary people. The price of heating homes in Britain in the coming winter will be three times what it cost last year.
Thank you very much. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseini on July 27, 2022.
The IRIP and our officials need to inform people that the Friday prayer is not merely a congregational prayer in a mosque. Rather, it is a great and important phenomenon in a city. Some of its features, which I will now state. I will first state these, then I will talk a bit about the gap that exists between the Friday prayers that exist today and how the Friday prayers should really be. Does a gap even exist or not? Naturally, there is one. What matters is how we can close this gap. Well, thankfully there are close to 1,000 or 900 in some Friday prayer leaders across the country. And this is a truly significant number in both big and small cities. They should really do something. If our Friday prayers, the way they are today, are the way that the Friday prayers have been defined to be and held in the way that is expected of them, then the situation should be a bit better than this. That is, there should be some differences. Therefore, this is one of the issues which I will discuss during my talk so that we can try to close this gap.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, who should be the one making this effort? A part of this effort that needs to be undertaken is the responsibility of the Friday prayer leader himself. The Friday prayer leader should make this effort. Another part of it is the responsibility of the respected officials who are present in the center for policy making and collective management of the Friday prayer leaders in Tehran and in other centers. As for the position that the Friday prayers hold, let me tell you in one word that the Friday prayer is a totally unique religious duty and there is nothing like it. When we look into the depths of the phenomenon of the Friday prayer, we see that it is even more unique than Hajj, which is a great multifaceted event. I will discuss some examples of these features now. If you think about this, you will find even more features, especially now that you're faced with this obligation yourselves. One feature is that the Friday prayer connects and ties together two essential factors that are part of a pure life. What are these two factors? One is the remembrance of God, dhikr. The other is the presence of the people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently visited Africa and said Moscow is currently developing a new foreign policy to counter fresh Western sanctions. Speaking in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on the last leg of his landmark visit to Africa last July, Lavrov noted that many countries are ending reliance on the United States dollar.
The
reliance on dollar as the instrument supporting the world economy is not very promising, frankly speaking. And it is not by incident that more and more countries are shifting to using alternative currencies, shifting to use national currencies more and more, this process will be gaining momentum.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent visit to Africa by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in what was seen as a diplomatic charm offensive amid tensions with Western countries over Moscow's military operations in Ukraine. The second part of our show will be on a report of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which urged African countries to rethink export diversification. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Russia counters West in Africa. Late July, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited four African countries in a bid to strengthen ties with the continent amid a six-month-old conflict in Ukraine. Lavrov visited Egypt, the Republic of the Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia, where he met with high-level officials and held discussions on bilateral, regional, and international relations. Speaking to Sputnik News, Lavrov described African countries as trying to define their own futures and solve their own problems as part of a trend towards a multipolar world. He accused the West of opposing such multipolar world in its pursuit of U.S. hegemony.
Africa's ties with Russia are based on Russia's historical support for the anti-colonial movement in Africa. Speaking during the 2019 Russia-Africa summit in Sochi, Russian President Vladimir Putin elaborated on the historical ties between the two sides.
Gathered here today are representatives of all 54 African countries and leading regional organizations. Dear friends, Russia and Africa are tied with traditionally friendly relationship. Our country has been consistently supporting the national liberation movement of the peoples of Africa. It has contributed significantly into the emerging of young states, developing their economy, establishing combat-capable armed forces. Our cooperation, which goes back to the period of joint fight against colonialism, is of strategic and long-term nature.
Now, to discuss the recent visit to Africa by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, we contacted Greg Simons, author and researcher, and would like to thank him for accepting our invitation today. Now, our first question, Africa and Russia enjoyed very cordial ties, especially during the Soviet Union, but these relations waned after the collapse of the Union. Now, what is the motivation behind Russia's renewed strategic interest in Africa?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Russia has been saying and doing in terms of its foreign policy priorities over the last at least 10, 15 years, it's been reorienting itself away from this Western-centric world towards a non-Western-centric world. And Africa has been part of that. And, I mean, in terms of relationships, certainly. I mean, if we look at the Soviet Union and its support for the independence movements and, in some cases, some of the reconstruction aid which was given during the formative years of African countries' independence, it's got a good basis for coming back.
During his visit to Uganda, Sergei Lavrov got a warm reception from President Yoweri Museveni, who had been a key ally of the West for decades. During the meeting with Lavrov, Museveni defended his country's relationship with Russia. The Ugandan president was emphatic that his country cannot be against Russia. Let's take a listen.
And that is our relationship with Russia. Russia, so the Soviet Union, supporting the anti-colonial movement in Africa. We say, but you people, these people have been with us for the last 100 years. How can we be automatically against them? We have even forgiven our former enemies, the colonialists, the ones who had colonized us, the ones who had actually taken slaves from here and did bad things. We have forgiven them, and we are working with them. How can we be against somebody who has never harmed us and who instead helped us?
Now, I would like to ask Mr. Simon his opinion about this statement by President Museveni.
Well, of course. I mean, he's saying it rather, well, directly, that the West has never really been there to help Uganda. I mean, they talk about these things, but of course the British colonised it, and Americans have been exploiting not only Uganda but the African continent, depending on where resources are most abundant. So what he's saying is that there is a basis of a symmetrical and a reciprocal relationship between Russia and African countries, which has not been poisoned, if we want to call it that, by historical experience of colonization by other European powers.
Trade between African countries and Russia has seen considerable progress. Speaking during the Russia-Africa summit in 2019, President Putin said Russian companies have been working in Africa for a long time now.
We see diversification of Russian export. Its structure is changing towards non-commodities. Russian companies have been quite successfully working in the region for a long time, mostly dealing with geological service and mineral resources extraction in energy, oil and gas sectors. At the same time, steps are being made to establish cooperation in high tech.
Currently, Russian exports to Africa are worth $14 billion a year, and imports of African products stand at about $5 billion. This represents a doubling in Russian-African trade since 2015, or an average annual growth rate of 15%. African countries stand to gain, especially economically and politically, from improved ties with Russia.
That Russia is open to different forms of ties with Africa. I mean, they already have what they would term as humanitarian ties in terms of these research and education programs which African students attend, but I mean, this would be going more into business and the area of forming some kind of financial relationship which is mutually beneficial.
The United States is in the process of passing a law titled Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act. This law, already passed by the House of Representatives, seeks to punish African states that back certain Russian actions and could have major implications for African countries. This legislation has attracted sharp criticism in Africa.
South African Minister of International Relations Naledi Pandor slammed the legislation as she hosted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his recent visit to the country. Let's take a listen.
But in terms of our interaction with some of our partners in Europe and elsewhere, there has been a sense of a patronizing bullying toward you choose this or else. And the recent legislation passed in the United States of America by the House of Representatives, we found a most unfortunate bill that we'd hoped the media would say more about, because when we believe in freedom, as I'm saying, it's freedom for everybody. You can't say because Africa is doing this, you will then be punished by the United States. So that's been a disappointing passage of legislation by one house, and we hope the other house will not agree to such offensive legislation.
Now, do you think other African countries will also resist this law, which seeks to undermine the independence and sovereignty of countries across the continent?
Well, I think this is an act of desperation from the US. I mean, they've been the bully on the block, uncontested, at least since the collapse of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. And so they've been able to do what they want, when they want, and there's been no consequences. But if we look at the reaction, for example, of the South African foreign minister, who was beside Blinken at the time, she said, "We don't take orders from you. We act in our own interests." So if anything, and this would be in keeping with other poorly considered coercive US foreign policy lately, that it is more likely to actually accelerate the isolation of the US in the world, because they see it for what it is, a bully that exploits.
Immediately after the Russian foreign minister concluded his African visit, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited three African countries, including South Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Thomas Greenfield, also visited Ghana, Cape Verde, and Uganda after Lavrov's trip to the East African country.
And my last question now, can Washington undo the gains made by Russia in the continent over the recent past?
Well, I mean, we've seen what they've been... Africa, like other non-Western countries, is watching what the United States is doing in Europe and in Asia, and they see nothing of benefit for them. In fact, they see risks and threats for them. They might tour, they might get a somewhat cordial welcome, but you can see the difference between how... on the African continent, Putin and Lavrov were welcomed as opposed to these other ones. I mean, it's a great deal of difference. I mean, you have this stiff, formal facade with the US, but with the Russian delegations, you actually have some human feeling. So this is about human relations. And they understand that the US wants to exploit and keep them down. I mean, this is what they've been doing for decades.
Well, our guest there says that African nations are aware that the US seeks to exploit them and suppress their progress. I would like to thank Greg Simons for his analysis. Now we now take a short break before our next topic on the need for Africa to rethink export diversification. Stay with us.
Africans urged to think export diversification. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says African countries must diversify their exports to survive economic shocks from global crises such as the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine.
In its Economic Development in Africa Report 2022 published last July, UNCTAD said African countries can diversify their economies through boosting exports of high-level services, expanding private businesses' access to financial services, tapping into new financial technologies, and implementing effective policies.
An African economist at this UN agency says there is a missing link in policies pursued by African countries, leading to lack of export diversification.
Most of the diversification strategies have focused mostly on either diversifying away from one sector into another one, or maybe diversifying within the same sector, trying to add new products and services without ensuring that the conducive skills, technology, financing and other structural factors are in place to kind of foster diversification into more value-added products and services.
Now, to discuss the UN report on the need for Africa to implement export diversification policies, we contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
And thank you so much for having me.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says Africa is among the least diversified regions in the world with regard to exports. Now, commodities account for more than 60% of total merchandise exports in 45 of the 55 countries in Africa, leaving them highly vulnerable to global commodity price shocks. Now, what's your view on this statement by this UN agency?
Africa's economy is dependent on primary commodity trade, and that already faces, of course, fluctuations and is easy to suffer shocks in terms of trade shocks when such disasters and pandemics do happen. So diversifying into value-added products, but also into higher value chains of products and trade, then makes it more easier for Africa not only to sustain her economy, but also to become competitive at the global value chains at this cost. So it is a very valid and fundamental prescription at a time when African countries are looking at jump-starting their economies post-COVID-19, but also when they have just concluded the continental free trade area that seeks to increase intra-African trade, but also Africa's trade with third parties.
British trade unions opposed to the European Union say a £30 billion a year subsidy regime allows the EU to dump thousands of tons of heavily subsidized food into Africa every year. As a result, local producers cannot export their products because they compete with the lower prices made possible by the EU's common agricultural policy. African and European farmers have been holding protests outside EU offices calling for an end to dumping by the EU. At this demonstration, an African activist explains how unfair EU subsidies are hurting African dairy farmers and forcing young people to migrate to Europe.
It's important because we have more than 40 million of people in West Africa who are living from milk production and livestock. So when you destroy their livelihood, they have no choice to migrate in Europe or abroad.
Half colonial and imperialist powers contributed to the stifling of industrial growth and value addition chain in Africa so that their own industries continue to thrive at the expense of Africa's industrial development?
The factories, the industry sector of Europe, be it from energy, be it from markets, be it from value addition, it is heavily reliant on Africa for the raw materials. So take raw materials out of the equation and the industrial sector in Europe, the manufacturing sector in EU would collapse. And that is why the EU, through agreements like the Economic Partnership Agreement, has been fighting so hard to ensure that we have, that the EU gets unhindered access to raw materials, but also unfair liberal trade regimes where cheap products from the EU will find their way in Africa and threatening.
The African Continental Free Trade Area aims to create a single market for the continent's 1.4 billion people. Speaking last year during the opening of Secretariat for the Continental Trade Body in Accra, Ghanaian President Nanu Akufo-Addo reiterated his country's preparedness to lead in the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area Initiative.
In Ghana, believe that an increase in trade is the surest way to deepen regional integration in Africa. It will mean a rapid increase in the exchange of agricultural, industrial, financial, scientific, and technological products, which would significantly enhance our economic fortunes as a continent, create prosperity, and provide opportunities for employment for the broad masses of Africans, particularly the youth.
UNCTAD says high knowledge-intensive services such as information technology and financial services could be a game changer for Africa, but they account for only 20% of the continent's service exports, leaving immense room for growth. Now, how can this sector be boosted in Africa?
Yeah, of course, that is happening. Currently, Africa is experiencing what development commentators call premature deindustrialization. Now, premature deindustrialization is where you find that the services sector, ICT and all that, is growing more and at a higher level than the manufacturing sector. Usually, it is the manufacturing sector which should grow and then provide a base for other sectors like the services sector to start growing. Unfortunately, we are seeing differently, and that's why we are having premature industrialization now. In order to ensure that we look at the ICT sector and the technology aspects contribute to development, it is important that we leverage on agriculture. We bring back connecting ICTs into the productive sector like agriculture, agro-industrialization, because our economies as Africa are built on the agriculture sector.
The African Union Summit on Industrialization and Economic Diversification will be held in November. Now, touted as a highly anticipated timely gathering, the summit is expected to unlock the continent's potential to industrialize. Now, are you hopeful that this summit will bring their desired changes?
No, it won't. Because later we need to, I am sorry for sounding pessimistic, because all the flags, the red flags already point to that, my pessimism. Because when you look at the requirements for Africa's industrialization and structural transformation, issues of technology transfer, issues of mineral beneficiation. To date, 97% of the mining agreements and contracts in Africa are owned by foreign entities, non-African. Value addition to date, in majority of African countries, value addition in the extractive sector takes place out of Africa. And there has been a lot of challenges when it comes to industrialization, when it comes to agro-processing, when it comes to infrastructure that is responsive for industrialization, when it comes to technology transfer.
Now there you have it. Imperialist powers are not keen on seeing Africa attaining rapid industrialization. So it is incumbent on African countries to liberate themselves from dependency on parasitic Western countries. I would like to thank our guest, Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist, for his incisive analysis today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question. This question is regarding a couple of Quranic terms that, you know, get thrown around here and there by a lot of people. But a lot of times, we don't really know the exact meaning of these terms and also the distinction between them. So today we're going to kind of look at the kind of precise meaning of these terms so we can use them, you know, in our conversations in a more precise and accurate manner. So these three terms are, the first is the nafs-e ammara, right? This has been used in the Holy Quran. Inna nafsa la ammaratum bisu, right? Really the soul, it entices or commands to evil. Then there's the shaitan, of course, obviously, it's a word that we're all acquainted with. And then finally, iblis. So let's start with this term, nafs-e ammara. In order to explain this term, we need to understand, first of all, the meaning of the word nafs. Right. So in Arabic, right, this term, it refers to the self, the human being's self, but a lot of times it's used with reference to the human soul because, you know, the identity of the human being is not tied up with his body. Rather, it's bound up with his soul. His soul is what he is. So sometimes this is used in reference to the human soul. Now, the human soul or the human self, human being, the human being's identity, right? This is something that possesses a lot of different states, a lot of different, you know, dimensions, and, you know, it goes through a series of, you know, it can go through a series of changes and states, right? So in the Holy Quran, there is the soul or this human self has been characterized in three ways. Sometimes it's ammara, sometimes it's lawama, and sometimes it's mutma'inna. Right, so these are three terms that the Quran uses, right, with reference to the human soul or the human self. And these are actually three states, or one might say three dimensions of the human soul. So what is the nafs-e ammara? The nafs-e ammara is the human soul or the human self when it is in a state in which it commands the human being towards evil. It commands him to do evil, to do bad things, and it entices the person towards the fulfillment of his, you know, base and carnal desires. This is what this term means. What about the term shaitan? This term shaitan is also a term, it has a negative connotation to it, right? But the term shaitan in the parlance of the Quran and in Quranic terminology, it is used in reference to anything, any kind of being which is rebellious in nature and, again, entices somebody to evil. Regardless of whether that that being is a human being or not, right? So from one point of view, this term shaitan and this nafs ammara, is they kind of overlap, right? But it's not necessary for it to be, you know, a human being. It could be a non-human being as well. And the term Iblis is a specific shaitan, right? So it's a being, a specific being, right? An individual, right? Who you know, according to the Quranic, you know, Quranic sciences, you know, he rebelled against God's order, and you know, he disobeyed the order to prostrate towards Adam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the difference between the nafs ammara, the shaitan, and Iblis. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
American immigrant family.
Part 1.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida, in 1998. Samir found work, and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps, pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son, Yusuf, was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him, he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that we hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even this legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, They don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, You're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him